How brief?
How brief?
One minute.
Our answer was 1 minute.
An abstract, the kind of thing you write in the crumpled up paper when you're sending off to a journal.
Okay, in my paper I sought to give a very brief sketch of Wittgenstein's elusive views on religious belief as expressed primarily in the notes on the lectures on religious belief and also the attention to some remarks on culture and value. I hasten to add that it was a very brief sketch and only touched on certain areas of a very complex landscape that appears to be out there. And so I had the chance to illustrate a few aspects of that, particularly the idea of, or rather the issue of epistemology within conception. And my main objective was to draw attention to the problem in Wittgenstein's otherwise beautifully rich picture of religious belief, that is, what is the cognitive content of religious beliefs under his conception? And my overall conclusion was that it's very hard for him to maintain that religious belief involves beliefs and yet seem to get rid of the things which we ordinarily consider constitute those beliefs in terms of their epistemic content, that is, the evidential aspect, predictive aspect, and metaphysical aspect that many religious beliefs share. And so I just want to draw attention to this particular problem of Wittgenstein's view.
Okay, thank you.
I was telling a sort of rather personal story about, you know, sort of my battling away with epistemology, which started off with being very impressed by what I'm calling the shifting of the bar height. Particularly starting off from Descartes, but the question of whether someone knows seems to be a matter of, you know, in this context, in this philosophical discussion, this person doesn't know anything at all because there are so many skeptical questions around. And then as soon as you walk out of the classroom, of course you know all sorts of things like the traffic lights have turned red and so on. finding this rather bewildering and being struck by the fact that deeply contrary to my own instincts, I find myself drifting towards relativism. So I've been trying to figure out what to do about this. I found I'd walked into a philosophical debate that was there long ago, this contextualism versus invariantism thing. So I spent a little time looking into that and came to the conclusion that the contextualist view was thoroughly defensible if one felt that the contextual character was attached to the justification and not to the knowledge. I wasn't trying to demolish knowledge. One or two people challenged me over tea and said, you know, you can't just chuck knowledge out. And I wasn't trying to. I mean, we all talk about knowledge all the time. All I'm saying is that the knowledge sort of slips around and it doesn't have this yes or no quality. This person knows and that person doesn't. And that this is a huge impediment to understanding epistemology. Only recently I've made a connection with something else and said, if we stop worrying about that problem, I'm not saying we just kick it into touch, but if we stop worrying about that problem and focus on a much more interesting thing, which is the question of how you go about understanding things and what brings about understanding, and this leads you towards explanation, but the whole question of how we relate to the world just becomes much more illuminating, because you're then pushed towards saying, well, what is it out in the world that brings the illumination, that brings the understanding? And so it seems to me that epistemology becomes a much more live and interesting subject if you just cast the problems in that light. I'm not saying you can't cast the problems in the light of justification and so on. And indeed, I've always thought that the best way to account of justification was to talk about coherence. But one of the reasons I like that was because actually coherence spreads out of your own mind into the coherence with what the people around you are saying. So it was a sort of social thing anyway. So you can have your justification, as far as I'm concerned, if you talk about it coherently. But I think we should devote our energies to try to understand what it means to understand something and what a good explanation is.
Thank you.
Well, I gave a quick run through the main theories of perception, just to draw the landscape. The way I did it was to jump off from what is our common sense understanding which has been formalised with the name naive realism, and say how Spanner was thrown in the works of that by the arguments from illusion and from hallucination, which suggested that if we can't subjectively discriminate between veridical and non-veridical perception, we've got no basis for saying that our perceptions are anything except just perceptions, which could be right or wrong. That is very much the basis of Hume's position, which became formalised in various ways by different philosophers as the sense data theory. Other philosophers took the idea that if all we've got is perceptions, then that is reality, and that is idealism or phenomenalism. Other philosophers then had objections to that and didn't like the idea of these funny little entities in the mind. So you had the adverbialists saying that the phenomenal experience of perception is something which can only properly be described adverbially rather than in terms of things. The qualities weren't instantiated in sense data, but could be done adverbially. It's difficult, though, to relate that to reality, and representationalists or intentionalists in the theory of perception came along and said, no, there are no sense data, and we get around the problems of illusion and hallucination by saying that our experience, our sense perception, is a way of representing experience. That is the current most popular form of perceptual theory, but they have been accused by a new breed of disjunctivists of saying, but then you are losing that real good truth about naive realism, that this is the way we get to know the world, and the world is part of our perception. They get around the argument from illusion and hallucination by saying, but they're different. Either you've got veridical perception, which involves the object, and this involves externalistic philosophy, or it only appears so. This may seem very unsatisfactory in some ways, but their main aim was to preserve the good idea of naive realism, that it is the world that is informing us when we perceive.
Thank you. Thank you. Question?
Okay, I gave a talk about applied epistemology. Basically, I started from the problem of natural language. Natural language is assumed to be a challenge for classical logic, which can be seen by the example I brought, vagueness. You can construct trouble by the Sorites paradox, for example, which then leads to all kind of trying to fix the problem by inventing other logics. And this led me to the theory, the epistemic theory of vagueness, which is the only one, only theory on the market, or one of the few theories on the market that explains vagueness in a way that is compatible with classical logic. But the main problem, and here's the, let's say, the epistemic or epistemological core, the main problem is a notion of ignorance of these sharp borders that we need in order to maintain classical logic. And I try to, I don't like this deep ignorance because I think, I want to save human cognitive dignity by saying, okay, these blind spots, this deep ignorance does not exist, so we need to understand the sharp borders. And I try to show that if we give up the idea to have objective borders or objective truths for expressions which involve vague predicates, so if we assume that vague predicates have are subjectively true, then we can save classical logic, and we can get rid of this notion of the ignorance, because in a way we better understand why they are sharp borders. And I found it important because of a kind of aversion against philosophers that claim that the human cognition is as blind spots, is limited, as some forms of ignorance that we cannot, well, understandable. And this was my main, let's say, concern to try to give an argument that we don't need. We can say classic logic, we can have sharp orders, but we don't need this deep ignorance. And we also don't need other logics, actually. So we need not to introduce complicated logical theories. We can rely on common sense and the classic logic.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, question please. Charles first. Keep your hand up if you want to ask a question now.
Rather a question, just a small comment on what was being said at the end of the last session, talking about meaning and how it's difficult for us and people avoid it and so on. For a chance, using the bowl as an example, and Wittgenstein, is if you want to know the meaning of a word, look at how it's used. He also said, in that, if I remember right, in that sentence, most of the time, or in most circumstances, so he qualified it too. That words are names of concepts. That large thing over there is a lectern, and it's a complex object, color, shape, etc., etc. We give that complex concept a name, lectern, to simplify our communication, so we don't have to communicate all the information about it every time we want to talk about it. So words name are the names of concepts. They refer to concepts. The meaning is a function of the concept. Inside your head, when you're working things out, it's the concepts we're thinking. We think it. We don't think in words, we think in concepts. So inside your head, the complexity is processing, and that's where the meaning lies. So words only have meaning very indirectly because of their association with concepts. And also, there are probably no atomic concepts. In other words, imagine concepts of some little circle. There are probably no little circles, conceptual circles, with something absolutely simple inside. All real concepts of objects in the world are complexes of clusters of other things. If you take the bowl thing, for example, the word bowl refers to a concept which includes skin, probably human, probably male, degree of area covered in hair, degree of area covered only in skin. There, for a start, you've got five concepts. Right? And that makes the problem, is he bald, is he not bald? At least it puts it in a much clearer context.
Okay, well, Charles is inviting you to agree with his theory of
concepts. Well, actually, we oversimplified the baldness discussion because we reduced it that baldness has to do with number of hairs. But maybe it has not to do with number of hairs, but with the thickness of the hairs, the density of the hairs, the distribution, and so on. So I think I agree that the problem is if you use the word concept, I also don't really know what a concept is, to be honest. I don't know what it is. I only know what things are, and how we can group the things. And what a concept is very, for me, it's very close to the word meaning. Yeah? It's true. It's, for example, I think these concepts have to do, you have a kind of pattern recognition process in the head, and we just cluster certain things in a way, and probably in a very arbitrary way. And then we call something a concept. But I honestly don't know what a concept is.
Another word for pattern. Four. Concepts are encoded information. Encoded four.
That's your definition, Charles. Yes. That's Charles. There are so many.
For me, it's a concept. I have a concept for me is giving the same output. For example, if I say bald to something, to an input, then there's a concept of bald. And then just all the things on which I react with the assertion he is bald, well, this is the concept of bald. I don't know if there's something beyond that. Yeah? This is the question for me, if there's something beyond that. Probably there is some psychological state where you feel okay, this has is some entity, but once you try to define analytically what a concept is, and I think Socrates showed us all that we will fail to try to define analytically by setting up a list of necessary and sufficient conditions. By the way, the same discussion for knowledge, how to define it, it's also a way concept. So I think it has more to do, it's a kind of holistic, it's a feeling, yeah? It's a subjective kind of holistic feeling. And fortunately, we live in a world where we are confronted mainly with clear-cut things, for example, tables. I think also they are not objective tables in some sense, but we are lucky because the things we construct, most of them are clear-cut tables. This is a clear-cut table, this is clearly not a table, and so on. So we are lucky that we live in a world where we are not exposed continuously to sorites continuum. Yeah? So this is the reason why I'm saying, okay, and then now how to build a concept out of a continuum. You have a table, you rest one atom, another atom, and so on, and you end up with one atom. So on this continuum, from one atom to the table, what is it that defines the table? Well, that's of course the use you give to it, the form, the size, but you can never precisely cut it down. So it's a kind of messy subjective cluster, yes, and you just propose.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. With this, I agree. Yeah.
Any of the rest of you like to comment?
Just make one comment on Charles's thing that it just strikes me that if you know far more about lecterns than I do, then when we're having a conversation about lecterns, we're not talking about the same thing.
Correct. There are in two people's heads. In any given quote, concept, you know, in quotation marks, word, concept, instantiated in any two people's heads cannot be identical.
But communication, if you and I are standing at the back of a lecture theatre chatting about what should we do with a lectern, the conversation goes beautifully, doesn't it?
Yes. I said identical, and I said the concepts are complex, they're made up of parts, and they're fuzzy. We can call it a concept, and we both know for practical purposes what we're talking about, and that's pragmatically, it's okay for us. But inside our heads, if we could in fact deconstruct and look at the informational content inside our heads, it would be significantly different.
But how are we going to? I mean, if you're the world's leading lectern designer, and I'd only learnt the word lectern 10 seconds ago, and we've got nothing in common inside our heads, and yet we can have a perfectly good conversation. I mean, it seems to me it's much more like atomic things that we're dealing with than these huge complexes you're talking about.
Well, I thought we could label it 2 months.
my concept has got to map onto yours with perfection, otherwise the conception is dead.
Either the concept or concept. Can I ask you a question as well?
Yes.
Charles, can I ask you a question? Why are you so comfortable to say that we think in concepts?
Sorry?
Why are you so comfortable to say that we think in concepts that we don't think in words?
No, it doesn't sound too good. It's far too long.
That's
hearing.
Right. I'd like to hear it. I mean, that separation seems to me rather odd. I'd like to hear how you have a concept without a word.
Right, I think it's time to move on to another question.
Right,
Mike
McKinley. Sorry, I'm going to have a rather simpler comment, I think, but for Frank. Talking about illusion, and you used a couple of times the example of the stick in water. Well, the stick in water, if you move away from philosophy and just apply a little bit of basic physics and understand the basic law of refraction of light, there is no problem, there is no illusion. You're seeing exactly what is there. You're seeing what you see is light, and that is what the light is doing. And there's no illusion involved.
I think
there's a trick in the brain somewhere possibly make you think that the trick is crooked, and it's fun to show the children, but there's no real illusion.
I think you're confusing illusion and delusion. I think the Muller-Lyer diagram makes it quite clear. You perfectly well know that the two lines are equal in length.
Yeah.
You can measure them. You can look into the physiology of the visual system and understand why those arrowheads produce this trick. But at the same time, so you're not deluded, but at the same time you can't get rid of seeing the two lines, the illusion persists.
But it doesn't cause you a problem, does it? It doesn't cause you any practical problem. That's
no, but it doesn't have to.
That sort of delusion doesn't cause you any problems. So.
But I think that abuts to something that's more important in a way, and that is the subjective indiscriminability of illusion and veridical perception. Sometimes you are deluded, and you don't know you're being deluded. So that's just another example of an illusion. But an illusion doesn't actually have to fool you to retain its status as an illusion. Same with a hallucination. You can rub your eyes and get sort of red dots in front of your eyes. You're hallucinating, and you're quite aware that you're hallucinating. But at other times, a hallucination, you may not be able to know.
I think the distinction I'm getting at is where you do know and where you don't know. If you have knowledge, it's still an illusion, as you say, and it's not a problem. If you don't realise you're being deluded, that's... I take the point,
Okay, next person was the gentleman there sitting next to Tatiana. Yes. Can you see on it?
Tim Bollett.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yes, my question was off. I was very interested in your views on Wittgenstein's thoughts that the religious belief don't involve metaphysical commitments or the use of evidence, whereas clearly, intuitively, we can see that if anybody has that belief, that you do think back to events in the past. So there is an evidential element to it. And you think about your behaviour and what might happen to you in the future, so you do have a certain metaphysical commitment. And yet, I can see Wittgenstein's point that you don't use evidence in quite the same way. And I just wondered, in relation to Peter's talk, whether with religion you lower the bar for your standards of justification for belief. And I wonder whether the reason for that is that such belief isn't something you use in this life. It's not instrumentalist in that sense. You don't use the belief that you're going to go to heaven to somehow gain in this life. And it reminds me of Pascal's wager, I think, is that there's nothing to lose by believing in God and being wrong. Sorry,
I've
not that
far away.
You know the one.
Yeah, okay, thank you for that. I mean, naturally, one approach to take towards religious belief would presumably be to in understanding the psychology of it and the genealogy of it, would be to look at what degree of criticism one subjects these beliefs to, in order to actually reach them, because from the outside it may look to someone as a case of a patent irrationalism or something to hold certain views. But I mean, that couldn't be worked into Wittgenstein's view, because he doesn't think that the genealogy of religious belief is that way. We don't look at the evidence coldly, as it were, and look at the beliefs and go, right, now I believe. It doesn't work that way. It's completely against that. And he even said at one point, it would be absurd to think that. Of course no one does that. If they do that, he would think they were utterly confused. So I mean, although that might be a way of looking at religious belief, which certainly couldn't fit in with Wittgenstein's view. Now, would Wittgenstein hold the idea that these beliefs operate not in this world but the next world? Well, that would then clash with a distinction he draws between faith and superstition. That he's very against superstition, very pro-faith, as it were, and superstition being the idea that, as it were, you believe something in order to gain in some way, or in order to alleviate a fear, for example, fear of death, and so on, you believe in an afterlife. And these are the kind of things he's vehemently opposed to. So that kind of thing surely would clash with that, and you couldn't hold on to that, wouldn't you?
I think what I'm trying to do, not so much
of the
Sam Wittgenstein, but
for
your own view.
My own view?
Oh. Because you do believe that evidence does play a role.
I do, yeah.
It doesn't play the same role that it would do,
which is all the same.
So Richard Dawkins strikes me as an example of someone who doesn't pay attention to religious beliefs for life, as Wittgenstein does. He just says religious belief is absurd because let's look at it in light of the evidence, and in light of the evidence, these beliefs don't make. Why would we conclude that? Why would we ever reach these beliefs on the basis of this? But that doesn't pay attention to the reasons why they make people believe. I mean, evidence is one part of why a whole is the world, which is what I was trying to illustrate with Wittgenstein. I think Wittgenstein paints a very attractive picture of things, and that's one that I would share. I also like the ideas that Kierkegaard has, that the only way to grasp certain ideas in religion is through, as it were, taking a leap of faith, in a way, because reason cannot comprehend certain things. For example, the idea of a trinity, a being being three beings. This is conceptually contradictory. It can't make sense with reason alone, so there needs to be some other way of approaching it. In my own view, it's a naive mesh of Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein, I guess, but I think the Wittgenstein pushes the boat out too far in order perhaps to protect religion. And so I would make what would appear to be a homonym argument against Wittgenstein, saying that he had personal reasons for defending faith, which is why he has this odd conception of it. But then it's not at home because it gets us to the reason why he did this thing. Called into question.
Does anyone else want to comment on that?
I mean, I have a question. Recently, I think Stephen Hawking claimed God does not exist. What is this proposition? God does exist or not exist? How would this fit into this scheme? I mean, this is clearly a statement making an existential claim, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can this be put in the scheme of Wittgenstein?
For Wittgenstein.
Yeah, but it's not. It has nothing to do with descriptive, verifiable.
Yeah. So, Norman Malcolm recollects that Wittgenstein once said to him that any idea of God as a kind of an all-powerful deity or any kind of creator struck him as repugnant. He thought this was awful. That's the idea. Partly, I think, because that involves the idea that God created the world, that is, created everything that exists. But presumably that involves the ability to conceive of the non-existence of everything that exists, to then wheel in the idea that a being could have created everything that exists. As it were, one needs to postulate something beyond that which exists. But Wittgenstein, throughout his writings, talks about how we can't conceive of this. We can't conceive of the non-existence of everything. We can't conceive of the complete absence of actually everything exists, so that might be a reason why he was struck at the absurdity of this kind of view. Wittgenstein also says in Culture and Value, an extended part of the quote that I think in the handout, that he doesn't talk past the religious leader who asserts that God exists, because he would never say God does not exist, because that kind of claim cannot be made. And how can you prove that? How can you prove that God does not exist? And that's why I would really be very careful with the kind of claim that Stephen Hawking is making. If he's saying, prove that God doesn't exist, I have an argument to prove this, because I don't see how you can prove a concept like God doesn't exist when you don't have empirical means of doing it, and it doesn't strike me as a priori means of doing it. It's somewhat strong of you,
Aaron. Stephen Hawking did not say that God does not exist.
Okay,
he said God did not create the universe.
He said it wasn't necessary. He said
God wasn't a necessary being.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as Laplace said to Napoleon, which was he did that type of thing.
A remark on that. I mean, the idea of the universe having a beginning is something that I think also Wittgenstein had a problem with. Peter Hacker, for example, said to me recently that he can't make any sense of the idea of there being this very first thousandth of a second beginning of the universe, or the beginning of things.
Wow.
And there's a few people more Wittgenstein than Peter Hacker.
You had a comment.
Yes, I just very much like the question, and the sort of connection with what I was saying. And I was just racking my brains trying to think, there was this point about
shifting the bar height of how there is just this phenomenon that when it suddenly becomes very important, people suddenly push the bar up, you know. And I was saying, trying to think myself, how could we get a situation where it became very, very important to get your religious belief right? And of course, the problem is, in this life, I can't construct a scenario. You've got the Pascal thing, it's spot on, you know. You can make this gamble of, you know, you can't lose, because you can't, there's no way that you can sort of, you can't point a gun at someone and say, get your religion right or I'll shoot you, you know. So I think it's somehow sort of, and so you're left with the question, when it comes to religious thought, where do I set the bar? You know, when, if I say there's a bomb in the building or something, you know, you say, well, have you checked? You know, you know how hard to set the bar. But there are some areas where you just sort of, I don't know where to start, but where to set the bar. So, yeah.
Right, Mike was next. Mike at the back.
It was curious because most of the way I found myself entirely in agreement with your train of thought, with your journey through epistemology. And it wasn't until you started answering questions that suddenly I got a jolt. I find the idea that you do have to separate very carefully the notion of understanding from the notion of knowledge to be very insightful and very helpful, particularly when judging scientific theories. But when answering questions, you suddenly said something like, of course, we need explanations in order to make predictions. Now, I can see how that works in ordinary discourse, where it is difficult or even impossible sometimes to differentiate between knowledge and understanding. But when I put it in the context of secular theories, I suddenly discover that no, it is knowledge that does prediction, whereas understanding is something completely separate. Wouldn't you agree with that? You know, it's like, for example, in Newtonian mechanics, you have the explicit formulae, explicit equations, which constitute our knowledge. We know that through, because we are confident that they will predict the world, and we will continue predicting the world, and we will plug for our numbers into them. But it is separate from our understanding of what's going on, whether or not there's actually space-time, or non-Newtonian space-time, or Einsteinian space-time, or whatever. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, but when I made the comment about prediction, I was actually thinking, this is not very satisfactory. So, well done, you spotted it. Something I just sort of add to that, I'm actually not quite sure about this, but it looks as if the pressure is that you have to act. It's not so much predicting, it's that when you're in a situation that you've got to do something, and you're faced with the choice of the story of, you know, can you trigger knowledge, and if you know, then you act, and if you don't know, then you can't act. Of course, a lot of these situations, you can't quite reach this trigger, and so you go into a state of paralysis, you know, this is the word you keep using, you can't act because you don't know, you know, and then you act, you say, well, I don't know, but I'm going to act anyway, and you think, what kind of game is that? So in the sort of understanding, you know, I'll act according to my best understanding seems to me a better scenario. So the prediction thing, I take your point, is a much more sort of delicate matter and is amenable to statistics and precision and, you know, sort of precise reasons and that kind of thing. So I'm going to shift my ground to a more sort of pragmatic, you know, action is where the action is, something like that. But, yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. I think Louise was next, and then it's you.
Which I got from all four of the lectures was a lot of it is based around anthropomorphism of the anthropotic, and the idea that the language of the mind and its geology is phenomenology. Cognition coheres, approximated emergence is polarity. But when you understand ontology, any way of understanding is like epistemology, the knowledge of finding yourself in that situation, the metaphysics of right and wrong in the situation, would you not pass that as executive stress and not be analytical? I mean, I'm not quite sure. Like, if you look at ecological centrality of upset to eugenics, of enrollment, of confusion, of hostility due to the empirical pragmatics of an ontology. I'm not quite, you know, I missed the point.
No, I could perhaps do the question repeated. Well, yeah, I mean, because you're at the back, I can kind of hear all of it, and there's a lot of big, complicated notions.
But the idea is, is the language of the mind, or probably should be going out to approximated emergence of polarity.
Right, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's a triple. Your statement, well, I'm not quite sure why you're really good. Your monotheism is theoretic, your dynasty. But the theory I got from all four lectures was based on anthropomorphism, a society of reality has been pushed too far due to the anthropotic. Of Palombo, it's not about Palombo's direction of the sea, like the Carpathian city. The idealist is the language of the mind of stress level.
Right, so how do the stress levels relate then to this so-called anthropological anthropocentric stand that we're taking?
Well, you call them ecology, it's competition of the species of eugenics. Anybody goes on ecology, which is the apperception of that situation. We have fertility rights and eugenics. A lot of people based on that perception don't. Okay, I find that as interpretation.
I don't feel qualified to.
Do any of you feel qualified?
I don't feel qualified. Wait a minute. We can talk maybe after that.
Okay, it's only a thing to discuss in the bar after.
Anne. Just before I ask the question, just to comment on the illusions, Lark. I speak as somebody who spent a whole lot of time involved in experiments with illusions. And when I now look, as I look yet again, at the Mulla Liar that you've got on your piece of paper, I cannot see the two lines as anything other than the same length. Our perceptions are educated. You know, and if you're in a very peculiar situation like I've been in, using so many bloody Mulla Liars, I cannot now see them as anything other than.
There's somebody.
That's not a question, that's just a comment. My question.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Can you take the mic when you answer, please?
I haven't asked any questions.
Well, can I comment on that, Joe? Right. There is a psychologist whose name I'm sure you will know who talks about a carpentered world.
Yes.
And I think since you know it, he gives you the whole answer to that little query there. Yes, I mean, you're right, but I don't think that affects the argument from illusion.
Well, I think it does, but that's not the question I was asking. So I can answer the question, of course, which is that in the last talk, Christian, you began your paper by saying we seem very much committed to classical logic. And by the end of it, I was so desperate. I mean, I just wanted to say why. In this particular case, maybe it's only in this particular case that I want to say, but you know, there are other logics, and of the ones that I'm no expert in logic, but of the ones that I've come across, there are logics which say that it's the yes or no feature of classical logic, which just is so obviously, I suppose, in many cases, wrong. I mean, somebody spoke earlier on when you're saying pregnant, you're either pregnant or you're not. Even that's not true. You know, you have to have operational definitions, and science always works with operational definitions. And classical logic seems to want to say, no, we don't need operation. It's either this or it's that. And it's just not true.
But I precisely try to show that you both things are compatible. If you make a judgment about baldness, and you only focus on the property baldness, then either it's bald or it's not bald. If you make a judgment focus on baldness and non-baldness, then it can be bald, non-bald, or bald. So there is a third way, but this third way does not mean we need a free-valued logic, for example, yeah? That we need yes, no, and we don't need another logic in order to accommodate for the idea of waveness. It was my message. You can, for example, create intermediate notions. You can say bold, you can say slightly bold, you can say medium bold, pretty bold, and bold. So you have, let's say, five intermediate values, and you would have between each of these
two values, you have an intermediate zone. Yeah? That does not mean that you have a nine-valued logic. So what I want to say is, yes, you're right. There is a place for giving answers like, well, it's not clear, the borderline. But this does not mean that logic, classical logic, which basically says very simple things, that each thing is determinately what it is, that if you have a set of things, and you take some of them, then the rest is the rest. So classical logic says very trivial things, I'm against the idea that we need another logic in order to accommodate for weightness. So
what about the non-trivial things? Classical logic is sensible for trivial things. Maybe it is. What about the non-trivial things? We need a logic for the non-trivial things.
Could be. Maybe for quantum mechanics you need another logic because there are attenuants. But for things as simple as the number of hairs on a head, I think there's no need to invent super-evaluationism or to invent degrees, truth of theory of degrees of truth and so on. It's just, you know, overshooting the thing. I mean, we have very simple concepts, red, ball, tall. We don't need another logic in order to accommodate for exactly what you said, for making borderline kind of statements.
Okay. I think Chris wants to come in there. Yeah. Do you want to comment on that question?
I just want to say, I don't think it's really a category you say to talk about a logic being correct or incorrect. I mean, there are many different logics. People study them. It's like studying triangles and circles. And the discussion here, I mean, the one, the Wittgensteinian discussion and the discussion about borders seems to me what you might call, we're doing replacement analysis. We're saying we have two discourses here where we apparently have puzzles and contradictions, and we're asking how are we going to change the way we talk to remove some of these puzzles. It's more like a scientist modifying their theory. So that's going on. And I think that when you talk about classical logic, that's a vague term because there's Aristotelian logic and then you've got propositional logic, quantification logic. And in order to do modern mathematics, you don't use classical logic. I mean, you use a version of Russell and Whitehead's logic and so on. So we really need a logic and you just choose one and then you might change it to do something else depending on your purposes. So you shouldn't say they're right or wrong. And there are logics where we don't have true and false. I think what they're called superlinear logics use that word. But there are logics that you allow.
But presumably that means you're going to choose an inappropriate logic for a purpose.
Yes. But you, there are logics where you allow contradictions.
Well, yeah. Well, it's true that what you said, obviously, there's not a logic that's true or false. It doesn't make sense because we presuppose a logic in order to say that something is true or false. So it's not possible. So,
can I ask a question here? I might have got this wrong, but I thought one of the problems with the Sorites argument is that you say because there doesn't seem to be a border, there's no distinction. And I think I thought that one tried to get rid of Sorites' arguments precisely because they denied a distinction between black and white. I mean, all of us know that there are clear ends, and we don't have any trouble about agreeing on them, and there seem to be objective facts supporting that view. But that there should be a distinction between A and B is not refuted by the fact that there's a fuzzy area in between. Mm-hmm. I think that's the deep problem. But I don't know.
You can have a bipolarity without a bivalence.
What do you mean?
Well, between black and white there's a bipolarity. Between hot and cold there's a bipolarity. Yes. There is no bivalence.
I know what you mean, but the problem is, yeah, in order to maintain classical logic, you should have a sharp cutoff point. I mean, and this means then, and it need not be bivalent. You can divide it in any. The important thing is that you have a sharp division. This is an important thing, and. What was said before is right. I mean, you can move other logics, like the logics which is decrease of truth theory. So there's not the truth can be, say, but partial truth is so if you go the expression he is bald is 100% true for a bald person, and for a half bald person it's 50% true, and so on. So this is one way to accommodate this idea. Okay, the vagueness is kind of a degree of this, it's half true, it's 25% true. But these logics have a lot of problems. You cannot go into detail here, but there are a lot of alternative logics, but they all have significant problems. They are not accepted for certain purposes. This does not mean that they are logic, and I believe that for other subject areas like quantum physics, maybe we need another logic, but not for baldness. For such a simple thing like number of head of a hair, we don't need a complicated...
In reference to Wittgenstein, you could use his meter rule example, where the meter rule is the what is determined by the method of judgment, and the meter rule is the method of judgment that gives you your standard of judgment, your decision, one way or the other. But the method is essential to the whole
Just two quick comments because we ought to wrap up soon. Okay.
Yeah. Just a quick comment. I mean, logic is hugely deep waters, and I paddled slightly at the edge, so I'm sort of terrified to make any comment. But I would just say, you ditch classical logic at your peril. That's my feeling. There's sort of general consensus floating around this room that because there are lots of logics around, and there are hundreds of systems of logic, but that doesn't mean they're all equal. And certainly, I mean, there's a paraconsistent logic devised by Graham Priest, which says, well, we can tolerate some contradictions.
Sorry.
And I noticed Anne nodding vigorously. Yes, life is full of contradictions. Well, life is full of contradictions. We can live with contradictions. But the question is, can you reason accurately with contradictions? I mean, if I say to someone in this room, look, you just contradicted what you said 5 minutes ago, I mean, obviously you can say, whoopee, I love contradictions. Great, bring them on, you know. But I mean, it's not even the way we normally reason. Any time I say, well, these two views of you hold, they contradict one another, you're supposed to back off and say, well, I suppose one of them is wrong. If you're really seriously going to give that up, I suggest you have a careful think about it before you do.
My point was precisely similar to that. Christian just made an interesting point a moment ago that no matter what logic you choose, you presuppose a logic in your reasoning anyway. So you use a logic where you... you don't hold steadfast the principle of non-contradiction. You allow there can be contradictions, but then presumably in your reasoning that, as it were, lies behind employing this system of logic, you don't allow contradictions and just asserting that something's true or false, to me, is the case or is not the case in just everyday human thoughts. I mean, I'm fascinated by this, and I'm also only treading the water in logic. I mean, I'd like to know what logicians say, though, about to what degree you can choose these logics. So you can choose logic to perform a certain task, perhaps in a domain of science where we face troublesome issues, for example, in quantum mechanics or something, we perhaps need a new logic for that. But then how far can that go back? Is it the case that we necessarily presuppose a certain logic in the sense that we think in a certain way and that maps on with a certain sense of classical logic? No, I agree with you that you can't machine these ways of thinking.
Like Peter, I'd prefer that aircraft designers didn't include contradictions in their
logic. Good point.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll wind up for now. Dinner's at 7, back here at 8 o'clock, where you can raise all the issues that you wish to with regard to epistemology. And will you be here? Will you be willing to ask questions? Excellent. Right, thank you very much. Take a borrow with you to the bar. You'll have to write the drink you choose on the back so that we get charged the right amount. Okay?
Yes.